and welcome to the Affairs Current podcast. This is our fifth or sixth episode, depending on how you count exactly. I'm, as always, your host, Carter Vance, and today we have a new host, although perhaps we can get into this extremely briefly. We did host a podcast years and years ago, so this is a bit of a reunion, but my good friend, Adam Barrett, why don't you introduce yourself, Adam?
Hi there, and hi everyone. My name's Adam. I'm currently a Master of Global Affairs student at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. I also lead the Journal of International Law and International Relations, and I happen to be a Queen Elizabeth Scholar and Research Fellow at the university.
Yeah, and the reason I say this is a bit of a reunion is because Adam and I co-hosted a podcast, which was, I assume, listened to by no one maybe one or two people. No one who we did not know personally back in high school, which was about movies. But anyway, so this is a bit of a return to form, I guess. Today we're going to be talking about two different topics. The first is the Polish elections, the second being, I guess, a discussion about China, which is going to be framed around the revision change, whatever you want to say, of the one-child policy. But just to briefly tell everybody again, our email, as always, is theaffairscurrent@gmail.com, our blog, theaffairscurrent.blogspot.com for all the show notes and everything like that. Okay, so let's talk about the first topic. So, Poland. Poland had an election over the weekend, and basically what happened is the party that got elected is called Law and Justice. Here's the interesting thing about Law and Justice is I can, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but this is perhaps, to my mind, the first time that what we would call a sort of welfare nationalist party has actually come to power in a European country, particularly by itself, because Law and Justice was in power before, in around 2005, but it was in coalition with some other parties, and the Prime Minister was not really aligned with the sort of broader project that the party has. So, but we'll get into that a bit. But basically, just to firstly say, they won a pretty substantial majority. The president, who was elected in a previous election this year in Poland, is also a member of Law and Justice. So now this party is basically going to have complete control of the Polish government. There's a lot of implications to this. Law and Justice are a very socially conservative party. They're very aligned to the Catholic Church. They are incredibly hostile to refugees. Not maybe the nicest people in the world. But they're a peculiar party in a lot of ways, because they ally this sort of critique of the EU institutions with a sort of more left-wing critique of EU institutions. They're also in favor of increased taxes on corporations. They've referred to, they don't want Poland being used as a, quote, German sweatshop. There's a lot of rage about, you know, Poland still has quite low wages compared to the EU average. It still has, even though it's had a lot of economic growth, it's accrued in this particular way, that the average Polish person doesn't really feel like it's benefiting them. And we should point out that, you know, even though traditionally Law and Justice's base has been in the eastern part of the country and in the more rural regions of Poland, in this election they actually won across the board. They won in the cities, they won younger people, they won older people. They basically cleaned house as far as it went. Now, we should point out the turnout was fairly low, but that's kind of normal for these sorts of things. So I guess the first question I'll throw to you is, do you think that there's any implication to this election beyond the borders of Poland, or is this just strictly a Polish thing?
Well, I don't want to overstate their case, because on the one hand, it is a national election for a country with very unique circumstances. But that said, what I worry about with the Polish election is that it's a harbinger of things to come. I worry that it's an indication that overall Europeans are becoming more and more distrustful of not only each other, potentially, with ongoing tensions, but also of the refugees who are coming in increasing numbers to their shores and their borders. And that's what really worries me more than anything about the Polish election, is just I worry that we're going to see a kind of revisionist tale whereby refugees are seen as some kind of threat to Poland or to a kind of traditional way of life. And that's what I really worry about with this election.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, like I say, they've managed to sort of ally this, left-wing and right-wing critiques of the EU sort of together in this sort of interesting way. As you say, you know, they've been, and we should point out that even the previous Polish government, which was Civic Platform, Polish politics is a bit difficult to sort of wrap your head around, because the two main parties are both parties of the self-defined right. Civic Platform, more sort of neoliberal, classical economics, a bit more socially liberal, substantially more pro-EU, law and justice, more socially conservative, Eurosceptic, etc. We should also point out that there, you know, the self-defined left in this election actually has no seats in parliament anymore. So if, you know, the right, the self-defined right in Poland is now running the show. But yeah, and even Civic Platform, as far as the refugees go, even Civic Platform had to be argued into taking 7,000 refugees, which is a ridiculously low number when you consider the amount of people coming. So even Civic Platform had to be arguing that. Now, the question is, you know, the first question is, you know, is Law and Justice coming in now going to feel itself bound to that sort of a commitment? Or are they going to just say, you know what, we were elected, we're throwing this out the window sort of thing? I guess, do you think that would be something that could concretely happen out of this?
The only way that I could see that kind of change happening really is with external pressure. So, i.e. Germany decides to really step up political pressure on Poland or something. Unfortunately, as far as I know, I think that Law and Justice, they're not pragmatic in the sense that as soon as they're elected, they'll start just reneging on promises here and there. I see this as evidence of maybe a bit more of a kind of commitment to this kind of policy.
So you think that they're serious about, like, because I mean, the thing was, you know, we should point out Law and Justice has been the Polish government previously. People may remember the plane crash which killed the Polish president several years ago. He was a member of Law and Justice, and in fact was the brother of the current leader of Law and Justice. So, you know, the point there is just to say that, you know, when Law and Justice was in power previously, they did not do crazy things. They didn't, you know, start completely pulling away from the EU institutions. They didn't start, you know, doing, there was a lot of tension surrounding certain aspects. But, you know, they were reasonably pragmatic and reasonably centrist when it came down to it. Now, of course, the different implication now is they've solidified their platform more. They have become more definitively this welfare nationalist party. And they aren't governing in a coalition anymore. It's just them, which is actually the first time that this has occurred in post-communist Polish history. So I guess the question then sort of becomes, do you see this as kind of a... Do you think there's a realignment in EU politics going on? And what I mean by that is, you know, we seem to be getting into this environment where the center-left and the center-right are increasingly sort of coalescing into a sort of pro-EU bloc, right? You've seen that in... for example, Germany, where the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats now govern as a sort of centrist coalition. You've seen that, you know, to some degree in France, where the Parti Socialiste has, you know, kind of become this sort of mushy centrist sort of party. You've seen that in, you know, a variety of countries where there has been at least a sort of consensus around that. But now you have parties of the left and the right, the further left, the further right, kind of cohering into this anti-EU message regardless of the way they frame it. So I guess the question is moving forward, is European politics now not going to be left-right, but it's going to be nationalist-cosmopolitan? Because that's really, in Poland, that's the divide. Both parties are of the self-defined right, and it's nationalists against cosmopolitans. Do you think that's the future of the EU?
Well, I think that's a very good point to make. I've always personally been kind of skeptical of the traditional alignment of parties along just the unidimensional left-right spectrum for exactly this reason, because you've got different dimensions like nationalists versus cosmopolitans, you've got economically conservative versus liberal, socially conservative versus liberal. That said, I do think that that's probably where I see, anyway, EU politics going, is the Euroskeptics versus the EU lovers, basically. And the interesting thing is I think that they may take very different forms in different countries. I think that those who are big fans of the EU may actually adopt kind of paradoxical, at least when we think of traditional conceptions of cosmopolitans, they may adopt kind of these very strange positions, maybe socially conservative positions, maybe economically conservative positions. But I do think it is coming down to those who see the EU and the Union as a way out of their problems, as a way to collectively manage threats, to collectively increase cooperation, versus those who want to return to kind of the more traditional model of nation states coming first. And it'll be interesting, though. I don't know where this is going to lead, really, at least in the sense of whether this is going to increase or diminish the overall power of the Union or not, but I think that that is where this is going, is this kind of cosmopolitan versus nationalist blocking.
Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing you point out about people seeing the EU as a place of broader sort of cooperational mechanism is that, you know, if you look at it just on paper, in terms of economic growth, in terms of governance stability, etc., the EU has actually been really good for Poland. You know, they've had a tremendous amount of growth. They export products and workers to different parts of the Union. They are one of the very few countries that avoided a recession in 2008. You know, it seems they've had, you know, a tremendous amount of growth since joining the EU, but it seems like even though that's the case and they aren't one of these countries that's, you know, suffering under EU-imposed austerity like Greece or Portugal or Spain, still you have this anti-EU sentiment. And I think that's very important to note that, like, it's going to manifest itself differently in different countries. In Greece, it might be, you know, with a hard left, well, I mean, we can only, it's a different argument for a different day about what Syriza is now, but nevertheless, you know, during the election in January, it manifests itself in this, you know, hard left, motley crew of Trotskyists and Maoists and democratic socialists, etc. In Poland, where there are concerns about, for example, EU forcing liberalization of things like gay marriage, of things like abortion law, of things like in vitro fertilization, which go against Catholic social teaching, it's going to manifest itself in this group of hard right welfare nationalists. So I think it's all about the particular, it's about the particular implications of what it means for particular countries. So, I mean, I guess, so the next thing I would just sort of throw to you would be, Law and Justice and the British Conservative Party sit in the same block, of the EU Parliament. And one of the big issues that's going to be coming up in the next few years is going to be the British exit referendum on the EU. Do you think that Law and Justice being elected in Poland has any particular implications for that dynamic, given the alliance between that party and the British Conservatives?
Funny enough, I think it's exactly the kind of sentiment that motivates Brexit. I hate that term, but that kind of sentiment of old-school, you know, perfidious Albion, kind of, the UK is something different from what the continent is. I think it's that exact kind of sentiment that's going to maybe diminish the impact of Law and Justice and impacting the kind of platform of the Conservatives. I think it's going to be much more dependent on local sentiment in the UK, how well the UK's economy is doing, whether UKIP can actually move past its fringe status, whether anger at the EU kind of increases or subsides. I think that's going to be more important, per se, than just the Conservatives in conversation with Law and Justice in the EU Parliament.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing, I mean, the weird thing is, you know, even though Law and Justice has a sort of level of Euroscepticism, they're not stupid. Like, they don't want to withdraw from the EU because they realize that, you know, a lot of Polish people go to work in Germany, France, England. Then they send their remittance money back to Poland. That's a big part of the Polish economy. So, I mean, I don't think that it's motivational in that way, but more to say that, like, perhaps of any of the Eurosceptic parties that are coming up, and I want to bring up something about Portugal in a second, the Law and Justice is closest to the position of the Eurosceptics within the British Conservatives, right? Like, if you were to somehow cleave off, you know, UKIP slash the what we would say further right portion of the British Conservatives, that would kind of be, and make it into one party, that would kind of be what Law and Justice is. So just sort of having that kind of critique within the EU institutions is perhaps likely to give more relevance to that case or something like that, I don't know. But the other thing I just wanted to bring up, just because I mentioned Portugal, was that, you know, this is another dynamic we've seen is in the southern European countries who are, you know, having this austerity imposed upon them by not just the EU, but broader institutions aligned with the EU, and it's seen as, you know, the EU doing this, and this has fueled increasing Euroscepticism in those countries. You know, and I talked in a previous episode about Portugal, the implications of that election, but that's actually developed in a really interesting way since then, has been that the three left-wing parties, the centre-left party, the Socialist Party, and then two parties further to its left, wanted to form a coalition government, and then the president basically said, no, you can't do this. And the reasoning he gave was, I mean, he sort of cited things about, you know, well, the largest party should get a crack at it first and et cetera. But then he sort of went into this divergence about, like, we can't risk market fluctuations, like, we have to, you know, it's important that we stay in the EU. And basically, and a lot of people were saying that, like, this is basically saying that the EU is now overriding democracy. You do not have the choice of a party, of a government which involves, you know, the Communist Party or the Left Bloc. I guess I'm wondering if you could speak to that and maybe speak to how that sort of sentiment might be fueling things in the sense of the EU being, regardless of whether it's seen as left or right wing, anti-democratic in that way.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, like, you just have to hear all the kind of adjectives lobbied at Brussels, the kind of shorthand for the EU, to know how much, like, anger, like, real substantive anger there is towards kind of EU government and EU bureaucracy. I think it is an interesting point because there's this idea of economic coercion, where if you try to do something that's outside of the orthodoxy, or you try to go against Brussels, or you try to make some kind of more interesting policy choice like that, you will be disciplined, per se, by the markets. And then we see the results of that in places like the example that's always touted out is Greece. And it is interesting. On the one hand, I think the case of the EU, or at least the kind of different elements of EU government subverting democracy is overstated, perhaps. I think it's often a Eurosceptic position that gets overstated. But on the other hand, it is a good point to make that you're losing kind of national autonomy, in a sense. And that's, it's all good to say that, yes, we'll be willing to give up some element of national autonomy in order to further cooperation to get ever closer union, but what happens when you start entering the much more difficult phases, when you don't have as high growth, when you're facing floods of refugees? it's in these kind of crisis situations that it really becomes a test of that kind of sentiment. Danny Roderick actually has a fantastic book out. I forget the name of it now, but he kind of poses that kind of trilemma. It's based on a similar kind of trilemma that's classic in international economics, but the idea that it's very hard to balance national autonomy, like having a functioning democracy, and also kind of growth, I think, is the third element. I could be wrong on that. And I think the EU is a very good example of that. It is very tough to balance out kind of the policies that are going to bring you into a closer kind of supranational union when there's still such a strong nationalist sentiment and each country faces radically different circumstances. And those radically different circumstances in some countries mean they're very close to the precipice of losing growth, of facing just dramatic changes to policies that people are not okay with.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, as you were saying, that's going to manifest itself differently in different countries, and I think over time it seems to be like there is, whether it's because of refugees or whether it's because of slowing growth or whether it's because of the loss of autonomy that's being seen, I think you're getting more and more and more of that in all EU countries, whether it's other than Germany itself. That seems to be the one exception, although there is that smaller Eurosceptic party, the Alliance for Germany, that seems to be growing a little bit, but it's been rather tamped down. But, you know, whether it's been France with the Front National, whether it's been England with UKIP, whether it's been, you know, Spain or Portugal with these left-wing parties like Podemos, etc., or, you know, again, as we go back in Poland with Law and Justice, it seems to me like this is a growing sentiment. And I think the thing was, you know, when it was, I mean, I think the furthest example this can go is Hungary, right? Like, that's the real example of a country where they basically don't want to abide by what the EU is telling them in terms of refugees, in terms of things like that. You have their prime minister basically openly identifying with a Russian-Chinese model of governance. But the thing was, I guess, about that, people were kind of willing to dismiss Hungary as this one-off exception. It's a small country. It's, you know, it's often seen as a sort of backwater of Europe. It's not as interlinked with the wider EU economy as other countries are. Whereas Poland is, you know, there was that remark about it being a German sweatshop, but there is truth to that remark. Poland exports all kinds of workers, all kinds of companies have gone into Poland to have cheaper labor, and all kinds of exports go into Poland because it's a growing consumer market. And a number of EU institutions are increasingly being headquartered in Poland. Frontex is headquartered in Warsaw, etc., etc. So I guess the question is, you know, it has less of an implication when it's Hungary that's governed in this incredibly nationalist way. When Poland, if that happens in Poland, I think there's much more implications to that for the wider EU economy structural basis. I think it has more implications. Or do you see it that way, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right. It is kind of disturbing because I think in many ways you're right, at least among the kind of commentariat. Hungary was always seen as a one-off case. Well, it's different. It's never quite integrated. It has its own history. It's kind of got this still remaining, almost kind of like nationalist superiority complex going on, or even victim complex going on, and it was always kind of written off that way. But one thing I think that this highlights, these kind of elections, these kind of electoral results, even the differential responses in it for refugees, things like that, is that you have two kind of troubling dimensions for the EU as a bloc. The first is kind of the economic dimension, where the periphery gets excluded from a lot of the activities that benefit the core. So the comment about Poland being Germany's sweatshop gets at this, where Poland doesn't develop its, or at least in many ways doesn't develop its own kind of industries or its own kind of headquartered, like, big firms that operate throughout the EU, and instead exports skills, workers, things like that to the core, which benefits more, and then some remittances get sent back, but it's kind of not really a balanced proposition there. And then the second dimension is kind of related to this periphery thing as well, where you've got differences between, like fundamental differences between many of the EU members. Those that used to be part of your ex-Warsaw Pact, your Eastern European countries, never quite got into the same level of cooperation, at least not in recent history, as the kind of Western European countries that formed the core of the EU when it first started, and that really have been the beneficiaries of the EU since. And because of that, I think there's this feeling of being left out. And when you combine this kind of periphery economic phenomenon with this kind of differences in culture and this kind of victim complex phenomenon, I think it starts to build into this kind of nasty trend where you start seeing places like Poland maybe buy into the narrative more that, well, the EU isn't working for us, they're making us do things that we don't want, we're not benefiting, now we have to take in a bunch of, in their mind, like foreigners who we didn't want in the first place. Why the hell are we even part of this? And it starts leading to these questions, and I think that's going to be really troubling as a political movement that we start to emerge, or that's starting to emerge with this kind of resurgent nationalist bloc.
I think there's two things I'd say about that. The first is that I think, you know, it's very right that you point out that, you know, these countries that form the EU are incredibly different in terms of their economic base, in terms of governance structure. I mean, there's a very real argument to be made that the problem of expanding the EU in this incredibly rapid way, particularly with... This is less of an issue with Poland, but more, I'm thinking specifically of Bulgaria and Romania when they did that expansion. Even though, like, EU officials were pounding the alarm about, like, Bulgaria and Romania are the, like, and I mean nothing against Bulgaria and Romania, but were incredibly corrupt. In terms of the way their public systems of governance function, EU officials were pounding the alarm about this, saying, don't integrate these countries, they aren't ready for it, they need a longer process. But the political forces were, we need to expand the EU, we need to bring more people in. If we bring them in, you know, and we get the structural funds going, we can solve the problem internally once they're in the EU better than we can solve it. You know, if they're outside the EU, which I guess is an argument, but then the problem was that was done in 2007, then the recession hit, and then all these other things sort of followed from that, so there wasn't that sort of planning. The second thing is, you know, I mean, there is a very real question about the economic integration of the union. I mean, the EU is fundamentally a political project, right? Especially the euro is fundamentally a political project. And, you know, there's that very famous study, I can't remember who did it, where they showed that, like, countries that began with the letter M would have made a better monetary union than the countries that made the EU on an or the Eurozone on an economic basis. So, I mean, there's that implication to it as well. But I guess sort of we talked long enough about this. So do you have any kind of final closing thoughts for this segment?
So just for some closing thoughts, I think the prime example of contradictions that we saw a few years ago was the euro, which, I mean, that is clear empirical evidence right there that there's very large economic differences between EU members. They're not this kind of optimal currency union. There's large divergence in what their needs are, what they face. And that I think just goes to show that the EU as a bloc, as this kind of group of nations, is going to face very different circumstances, despite the fact that they all face these very common problems. Whether that's the refugee crisis, whether that's the fact that the entire continent is aging, whether the fact that that's economically they're heading to low growth. It's going to be very interesting, I think, to see how these kind of fundamental differences also manifest socially and politically, whether we're going to see kind of solidarity amongst the countries pop up.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, no doubt. We can observe it carefully from across the ocean and then, you know, build the Atlantic Wall if need be. Okay. All right. Well, with that, I think we'll move on to the next segment. Okay, and we're back at the Affairs Current. For our next segment, we're going to be talking about China, but I will let Adam introduce it.
So, recently, actually just a couple of days ago, China made a very dramatic change to one of the most infamous and notorious policies, the one-child policy. What has happened now is they're actually allowing what used to be the case, which was you were only allowed to have one child for the most part. There were some exceptions made if you were, for instance, from an ethnic minority, or if you were from a larger family, I believe. But now what's happened is so it used to be that if both parents, especially, were only children, they were only allowed to have one child. Now it has been changed so that if there's only, sorry, I totally said that wrong. It used to be that unless both parents were only children, they could have more than one child. But now the case is that you only need one parent to be an only child in order to have two children. So that sounds like a bit technical of an introduction, but basically what that means is that something on the order of 100 million families will be able to have more than one child now, which is a huge, huge change to the very kind of restrictive and dramatic one-child policy that we've known for the past 30 or so years. So we're going to, I think, take a look at what that means for China, what that means maybe for the region, and the different effects that this should have. So do you...
Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple of things to first sort of point out about this. The first thing is that you're right that, you know, this is probably, if people know one thing about public policy in China, if you ask, you know, the random person on the street, like, what is a government policy in China, they would probably be able to tell you the one-child policy. So it is, you know, very much something that has been huge in terms of China's attempt to develop and attempt to control its population growth over the... When was it instituted? The late 70s? It was Deng Xiaoping, right?
Yeah, I think it was in 79.
Okay, yeah, 79. So it was definitely, along with a lot of other things, the changes that were made to the Chinese public policy and economic construction by Deng Xiaoping, this was one of the things that came along with that. But you're right to point out that, you know, this policy always had exceptions to it. If you were an ethnic minority, if you lived in a rural area, if you were from a smaller family, it didn't apply to you. And, you know, this is ultimately a modest reform, right? I mean, in terms of the actual policy, in terms of its implications, it's wider just because China is such a huge country. But, like, this is not reproductive freedom in China. It's basically making a one-child policy into a two-child policy, right? So I think – okay, so here's what my thinking, and maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong about this. I don't think that Chinese policy leaders do anything until it's the right time to do it from their perspective. And what I mean by that is I'm fairly certain that – I'm fairly certain that the people who decided to make this change in China have assessed things and they've figured out that China's gotten to the level of growth that they don't need this artificial curb in order to get the policy result that they want. Because, you know, this is true throughout history that as countries develop, as they become more industrialized, birth rates go down. That happens for a variety of reasons. You know, people move into urban areas, they have less space to raise children, they don't need to have five kids to look after them when they're old, because there are state mechanisms to do that, or there's you know, other ways of doing it, private insurance, whatever. You know, another big thing, you know, that we should probably point out is that women have rights and aren't treated as you know, chattel. So that, you know, has a huge effect in terms of, like, reproductive autonomy for them. So I think that, I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I think there's probably been an assessment made over a longer period of time that, you know, China is now sufficiently urbanized, sufficiently developed, that it isn't going to have this huge implication if they ease off on this policy. Now, as to why they're doing it, I think there's a number of reasons for that that we can examine. I mean, I think the first thing, perhaps, to point out is, you know, China's undergoing some pretty difficult economic times right now. This is a night, in terms of domestic political considerations. I mean, yes, China is a dictatorship, but it rests on a certain level of legitimacy and consent from its population. This could be seen as just sort of trying to distract a bit from the current economic news by giving out this, you know, nice new policy. But there's, of course, a much wider implication, and it's this. China's gender balance is horrible, and it's largely because of this policy, this one-child policy, combined with a social preference for having male children. This is, you know, why so many girls are adopted from China and go to other countries. I mean, and more horrifically, why there is a lot of gender selective abortion and feticide in China is due to a combination of these two things. So I think there's two considerations that were probably made by the Chinese policymakers. Is one is they've reached a point where they don't need to get this heavy-handed curb on population growth. The kind of development cycle is starting to do it for them. And then the second thing is that, you know, the damage is kind of already done as far as the gender imbalance, but there's at least some attempt to move that forward. Now, that's my interpretation at this point, but I'm not sure if you feel the same way.
So I feel largely the same way. I think the main motivation for this is just looking ahead. The government sees that this gender imbalance, and gender imbalance is, by the way, beyond the kind of, like, obvious kind of horrifying fact of, like, just kind of the sexism that it implies, there's also evidence to suggest that gender imbalances are not good socially. They tend to raise the risk of internal, like, unrest, internal turmoil, social imbalances.
Well, yeah, you're going to have a bunch of, young men who aren't going to have, you know, the chance to get married, to have families, to, maintain those sort of social bonds that kind of provide stability for a society, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's something that they're looking at. As well, one implication of the one-child policy is that China, in addition to developing, is also aging very rapidly, and this is a problem that's going to come up very, like, sooner than I think most people are comfortable with. The fact that you will have so many elderly that aren't going to be supported by enough people, especially considering that in Chinese society, because of its kind of preference towards, part of one of their cultural values, anyway, is that the young should support the elderly, they should support their elders, and that is going to come under attack as you have less and less young people to support a growing elderly population.
And they also haven't developed to nearly the same degree that Western countries have the sort of substituting state mechanisms to do that in the absence of having actual, you know, children there to take care of you in your old age.
Exactly, and that's something they've started moving towards, having these kind of welfare systems that should substitute for the presence of younger generations, but it's still very much a work in progress, and it's still happening at a very differential rate. One thing I should also note, actually, is that we tend to speak of China in these very kind of, like, homogenizing terms, like, the society is aging, or there's going to be less young people overall, but it's important to disaggregate it. So, for instance, this is going to be a huge problem in the rural provinces. You're already seeing a huge kind of migration as China urbanizes, and it's going to be the elderly there that are disproportionately affected. It's going to be the men there who cannot find anyone to marry and raise a family with, because most of the women have headed towards the cities, that are going to be also disproportionately affected. And considering that there's this high premium on family lineage as well, I think that is going to be a very dramatic situation, pitting the kind of rural provinces against the urban centers.
Yeah. Well, I think another thing to examine about that is actually in terms of not just the elderly themselves in those rural areas, but a lot of the sort of migratory patterns in China tend to follow this formula. People grow up in a rural area. They then, once they're, you know, in their 20s or whatever, they move to a city to work. But they, and then they may have kids, but they leave their kids behind with their parents, so the grandparents, to raise them, right? And if the society is rapidly aging, and then a lot of those older people are no longer going to be there to raise those children, I would. And now maybe, you know, Chinese families will just become more nuclear. The children will live with their parents as opposed to their grandparents more. I don't know. Probably that's what will happen. But there would need to be some sort of policy responses to make that tenable for people, which don't exist anymore. I think in a lot of ways, the whatever you want to say, traditional Chinese family structure has been kind of subsidizing and substituting for the development of an effective welfare state, the economic development of China. And now, you know, somebody's left holding the bag, and, you know, the government hasn't developed these structures. They're starting to move in that direction because they've recognized it. But they also have to sustain a really high growth rate. And the problem is now they're hitting a period of slowing growth. They're also hitting this period of people aging. And I think, you know, the repeal of the one-child policy or the modification of the one-child policy is a recognition of that. But at the same time, I don't think it's adequate unless it's coupled with a whole lot of other things that they would need to do.
That's absolutely right, I think. I think we're going to need to see a very very sustained change to current public policies, especially about welfare systems, especially about kind of balancing some of these effects, also about balancing the kind of rural-urban split. I think the more and more we're going to see, there's already been some resentment for the one-child policy, but we're going to see more and more resentment of, like, the hukou system that kind of prevents migration towards urban centers in some cases as well, and I think that's going to be start becoming a flashpoint. And I think we're going to, in order for China to navigate these kind of very large shifts over time, the shift towards aging populations, the shift away from the incredibly rapid growth that they've had, it's going to require very careful policy calibration, which will be something to watch for.
So I wanted to throw out an example of a country which managed to do this sort of transition reasonably effectively. It's actually Singapore, who, you know, it should be noted that there is fairly substantial and convincing evidence that Chinese policymakers go to Singapore to learn about their development, that they take advice from Singaporean policymakers and things like that. So I don't think I'm just, you know, using a random example here. I think there is actually a substantial connection. You know, people forget this. Singapore had, at the time of its independence, Singapore had a very high birth rate. This was seen as a problem. They didn't do quite a one-child policy, but they definitely made a sustained public policy attempt to curb the birth rate by basically only providing state support to the first two children that a family would have, right? And then, see, the interesting thing about that, though, is that they actually did it too well. And now Singapore has, well, it's starting to go, because what they had to do at once they realized that there was creating this bizarre population curve was they had to actually start subsidizing people to have more kids, right? And I think this is, you know, points to a fundamental problem with any of these sorts of policies, is that unless you institute a very heavy-handed curb in the way that China did with the one-child policy, it's very hard for governments to do anything to affect the birth rate, because so much of it depends on social trends, culture, economic development, all kinds of things that are kind of Does the government have an influence on that? Yes, but not directly. I mean, you've seen in Europe where, you know, as we alluded to in the previous segment, there is this problem of aging population. European countries have tried all kinds of things to try and get the birth rate back up. France has been a bit successful with it, but, like, they had to dump an incredible amount of public policy money and time into doing that, and for, you know, perhaps negligible returns, who knows. So, I mean, I guess the question there becomes, like, are we going to see, is it going to follow the Singapore trend where, you know, in 20 years, I'm going to be sitting here talking about, you know, China giving people incentives to have more kids because they've realized it. So I don't know what your interpretation of that would be.
So that's actually a good point there. I think something to remember with all of this is kind of the key lesson that people learn when they're studying things like policy analysis or something is that just implementing a policy doesn't necessarily produce the outcome you want. And so it's one thing to say that people can now have two children. It's another thing altogether whether they'll actually go out and start doing that. And given the evidence of China's increasing income in many families, it's unclear whether there's actually an incentive for people to go out and even have more children. Some people surely want to, and it'll be nice that there's not, or hopefully an ease on the kind of very draconian kind of policies that we saw, especially in when dealing with more rural and not the wealthy populations, when officials would come in and have very incredibly heavy-handed tactics for enforcing the policy. So that'll be nice to get rid of that, or at least ease it, but it's not at all clear that just changing this to allow two children now instantly means that people are going to have two children.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think that's the other thing is, you know, regardless of whether you, as you say, you know, you can have the public policy leniency, let's say, to allow people to have two children, but, you know, there's all kinds of questions. I mean, people are moving to smaller apartments in urban centers in China. There's questions about, you know, whether there's even the space to raise two children, you know. And you know, again, I think there's a general trend that you can look at throughout the history of development in every place that it's occurred, is that people just tend to have less and less kids as countries become more developed. And I don't, you know, I think, you know, there is this sort of notion that I think exists in Western countries about China, which is that, like, Chinese policymakers are somehow these, like, genius mandarins who can just do anything and create any sort of, you know, policy outcome that they want. But, like, ultimately, no, as you say, like, you can make a policy. Whether people will follow it depends on all kinds of things that you don't necessarily control. People are making all kinds of decisions throughout their lives. Government shapes that, but it doesn't determine it, even if, you know, you are ultimately a dictatorship. If you're not, you know, completely in there micromanaging every aspect of it, you're not going to get necessarily the outcome you want. You might get an outcome that's similar to what you want, but, you know, and I think, again, like, I think I had a previous discussion about this with somebody about Russia, where, you know, again, like, people think, you know, these people running these countries are these genius chess players, you know. But ultimately, I think they're subject to the same sorts of fundamental socioeconomic constraints that everybody else is, you know, even absent, you know, democratic will of the population.
I think that's absolutely right. I think, and this is why I brought up this kind of idea of, like, that people look at China in these very homogenous terms when it couldn't be farther from the truth. I mean, not only do you have, you have this image of the genius policymakers that really isn't sustained in reality, not only because of the fact that they're working under incomplete information and all that, but also because of the fact that in China especially, you've got huge provincial differences. You've got competition between all levels of government. You've got competition within the internal party structure. I mean, this means that not only is there the challenge of actually doing a policy that does the intended outcome, but also doing so in a way that you won't be, like, politically bested in a lot of cases. So that means that on top of these challenges of doing the right thing, which isn't easy, which I think Western countries tend to overstate because there's kind of this envy of China's growth rates, which really just come from rapid industrialization of a massive country, nothing more, really. And so pairing this with this kind of, I want to say mystique, but there's other more pejorative terms you could use for Western views here, of how these countries really operate. And I think that image comes together when, and just makes people not really appreciate the fact that, no, there's tremendous challenges in actually achieving the outcome that many of these policymakers want. It's not all clear that this is going to happen. It's not all clear that this policy is going to be a success. It's not all clear what's going to even happen in 5-10 years from now.
So I guess the question is, if China becomes a, you know, fully, it continues to develop, continues to grow, but it has this problem with population, do you think that it's going to have to start encouraging immigration to itself in the way that other developed countries have tended to? Because, I mean, there is some evidence of that, you know, Vietnamese people coming to China to work and things like that, but certainly it's not a sustained policy move on the part of the government, at least at this point.
So that's a very interesting question. On the one hand, you're right, that's been the response of many developed countries, is when they do start facing these kind of declining birth rates, they start opening up the immigration more, start trying to make up for it. And in many cases, it leads to good outcomes. Immigrant and diaspora communities tend to have like very high rates of entrepreneurship. They tend to make great contributions. But I think there's a bit of an issue in doing that for China, and the first being that they don't really have nearly as much experience in doing that, per se. I mean, any move to really open up immigration would be very unprecedented for the Communist Party. It would be very interesting to see how they would go about that as well. I think some people who've gone to China can attest to the difficulties sometimes in even just getting a visa. So it would be interesting to see what their response is. As well, I think that one difference is that China has a very long history in the region, especially with these other countries, and I think that the shadow of history here may actually have an effect on immigration. Not only this kind of idea that, I think that there's kind of this kind of cultural idea in China that they are the kind of, they are the big deal in the region, to put it bluntly. And because of that, there may not be this kind of incentive for people from neighboring countries to, unless there's strong enough like economic incentives, which there might be. Again, it's hard to tell, but there's still kind of a social or cultural barrier there that I think would need to be addressed somehow in order to really spur immigration that could make up and make up for the fact that birth rate is below replacement rate right now.
Yeah, and I mean, the only other example of a country that, I suppose there's South Korea and Taiwan, but that's kind of a different thing. I was going to say Japan, at least was the first country in that region to really become what we would consider a developed country, right? And they don't have any immigration at all, basically. It's almost impossible to immigrate to Japan. There's Koreans who are in Japan who have been there for several generations who still don't have Japanese citizenship. Now, we can, you know, that's a different discussion about, you know, why Japan doesn't want to encourage that sort of immigration, even though that's actually probably, you know, if you want a preview of where this ultimately all heads in terms of Europe, in terms of China, as far as an aging population goes, you know, Japan is really, you know, the apex of that as far as that goes. But yeah, I mean, if Japan had ever gone in the direction of encouraging immigration as opposed to like really discouraging it, we might have an example of a country in the region who had done that successfully. Of course, we don't. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. You know, there would be tremendous challenges to doing that. But I think it ultimately might have to be done out of necessity rather than, you know, wanting to do it. Because, I mean, let's be frank, you know, there were and are all kinds of concerns about immigration in developed countries that in terms of the policy basis for it, but ultimately it was done anyway because it was necessary, right? So, I mean, I think at a certain point, particularly when you don't have to answer to an electorate, you know, you're probably just going to do it regardless of what the public sentiment might be, and you can try to manage that sentiment a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I would say that's probably where you end up here.
And I think you're right. I think at some point they're going to have to start looking, especially because I'm still doubtful that, absent some kind of policy shift, there's going to be enough incentive for many of these families to really start having more children and getting back to the replacement rate demographically. So I think we will start having to see kind of these more, at least compared to the status quo, radical moves like opening up immigration. My concern with that is one, if it's not managed well, that could hugely backfire. I mean, for instance, if diaspora communities are treated poorly, that could raise regional tensions. You could get some conflict with kind of Chinese nationalists. There's a lot of ways that it could go wrong,
But isn't that the case of any country where there's a substantial rate of immigration? Like, you know, you say Chinese nationalists, but I mean there's European nationalists.
No, that's true. That is absolutely true. This is the case in any country. It's just when you've got such dramatic magnitudes that you get in China, you've got just such a large population and just such large groups of people. I think the concern there is just you've got to be extra careful in calibrating policy. And that would be my big concern if they were to do something more dramatic, like opening up immigration, like really dramatically shifting incentives for families. And I think the one-child policy is actually instructive of that. If in a lot of ways, I mean, you can call it a qualified success if you follow certain caveats by saying, well, if you follow what the party said, and was that it prevented 400 million births, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of people who would argue you could have just achieved that through normal industrialization. You didn't need that kind of policy in the first place. So
yeah, and I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I'm sure that the Chinese government has some way that they disaggregate it, but it's very difficult to determine how much of those 400 million births were prevented by this policy versus, as you say, the normal effects of industrialization. It's very hard to determine that because, you know, it's all about incentives. It's all about, I don't doubt that, yeah, like some people were discouraged who otherwise would have had more children due to this policy. And I mean, of course, this doesn't even get into any of the human rights implications of it. You know, obviously that there's, you know, but let's leave that to one side. Let's like just examine it purely on what the party said it wanted to do. Yeah, you know, you could say that, but then the problem is, again, you get the Singapore problem of you can have a policy, but the policy combined with the normal effects of industrialization end up working too well, and then you have to shift things in order to, as you say, get back to that replacement rate. And the problem is, by that point, A, you've already industrialized some people having less kids anyway, and then B, you've also inoculated a sort of cultural norm against having more children when put a very heavy-handed state messaging upon people to in terms of values, in terms of all that kind of thing. You know, an anecdote was once told to me by a person who was from China, and they were saying, you know, we were talking to him about abortion, and it was, you know, they said to me, you know, in China, women, when they would get abortions, would say, you know, I'm doing this for the good of the country. We can't have more kids, right? And that was the messaging the party was putting forward. And, you know, when you put that messaging forward over a long period of time, over 30 years, people start to internalize it. They start to think in that way. And I think that, you know, this is the problem, is when you try to shift incentives rapidly, you know, that takes time to filter through the public psyche. And I don't know that any country has ever been able to do that successfully yet.
So that's actually a really good point, Ben, internalizing there. And the reason why I've been kind of emphasizing the idea of calibrating policy here is that I think despite the fact that many Chinese policymakers probably went to Singapore, learned from kind of the school of thought of Lee Kuan Yew and all that, I think the one-child policy was an incredibly poorly calibrated policy. Not only was it kind of very dramatic in what it forced on families, but when combined with the kind of family ideal that existed, like Zhao, or like filial piety and all that, that people harp on, I think that, and the fact that there's kind of differential effects, especially when you look across income groups, across the rural-urban split as well, I think that it was very heavy-handed, and probably is that aims could have been achieved with a much lighter touch and with just letting China grow in the first place. So that's my concern in moving forward as well, is that any kind of response to the initially poor policy is just also going to be shifting the pendulum too much and will also be...
So do you think it's just going to be poor policy compounding poor policy at that point?
And that's my worry about this. And that's why I think it's instructive to challenge the kind of myth amongst Western audiences and Western commentators that, oh, well, look at these genius policymakers. They will do these dramatic things and achieve such great aims. Well, yes, magnitude-wise, it's remarkable, but policy-wise, I think it's a failure.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's again, you alluded to with the growth rates, and, you know, they're, by some calculations, China has the largest GDP in the world. Now, but you know, I mean, I once said to somebody, you know, if you think about this logically, China should have the largest GDP in the world. It has the largest population in the world. Like, you know, if you want to get to a point where every country is, you know, reasonably developed and people are reasonably prosperous, yeah, China's going to have the biggest GDP. You know, that's going to be the reality. And I know that, like, you know, some people, for a variety of reasons, like, don't want that to happen. But, like, you know, if we actually have the goal of sustained global growth, that's what's going to happen, right? And regardless of what you do policy-wise, almost.
Mm-hmm. At some point, there will be this kind of... Because it's policy that affects things like economic growth, but obviously it's things like demographics that probably play a larger role. And you're right. I think when we look, or if the world kind of moves on this kind of convergence track, then it will be China that has the largest GDP in the world. It will be China that's probably the largest economy just by virtue of the fact that it has the most people. And it, in terms of numbers, it's going to be largest.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that's good for that discussion there. Do you have any final thoughts, though, just before we wrap up and move on to recommended readings?
So it's going to be very... I just want to see where this goes more than anything. I mean, we only heard the announcement a couple days ago. China's in a very, very interesting place. I mean, you've got a lot of shifting currents right now. You've got a lot of social currents that are shifting, and the conflict between kind of trends and traditional values. You've got a lot of shifting economic currents. Domestically, I wonder what's going to happen, if there's still going to be this kind of credibility of the party. Internationally, I wonder if these kind of demographic changes are going to lead to tensions or perhaps kind of rivalry between China and someone like India, who may eclipse them in population. I don't know. Overall, I just think it's a very interesting shift. I think it's emblematic of the fact that there are even larger shifts going on.
Okay, well, I think we'll wrap up there for that and move on to recommended readings. Okay, and we're back on the Affairs Current for recommended readings. I will first throw to Adam.
So, recommended readings for looking at something like China's one-child policy are kind of all over the place. I mean, the fact that it's just changed a few days ago means most of your good commentary is limited to kind of long-form journalism right now. There's a great article in Foreign Affairs by Baoshen Lo, who writes that China is going to be, contrary to kind of the conventional narrative, China's actually going to be rich enough before it grows too old, so that it'll be able to fully compensate for the kind of demographic changes that it faces. But you can also, so that's a great piece of commentary. In terms of more traditional books, I think that there's a great book on looking at the overall impact of China's one-child policy. I think it's Stephen Mosher who writes China's one-child policy 25 years, or sorry, I'm thinking of a scholarly article there. Book-wise, Governing China's Population, Leninist to Neoliberal Biopolitics is actually kind of an interesting look overall at the impact of China's one-child policy and what it means in terms of how they make policy. So those are some interesting reads right there.
Okay, so we'll link to those on the blog there. So my recommended reading for this week is it's an article in the New Statesman. It's basically about there's recently Isaiah Berlin's letters have been published in book form, and this article is kind of a review of that book, but it's more about Isaiah Berlin, who's of course famous philosopher. But he's kind of fallen by the wayside in terms of the way people talk about great philosophers of the 20th century. And this article is basically making the argument that Isaiah Berlin's thoughts, even though he was very much writing in a certain sort of Cold War kind of anti-totalitarian context, his thoughts are still very much relevant, are still very much informing politics today. And they have a lot of implications for moving forward. So I thought, it's an interesting little article. It's not too long, and just sort of caused us to, maybe go back and reflect a bit more about what Isaiah Berlin was talking about in terms of, his conceptions of freedom, his conceptions of the nation state, his conceptions of human rights, and all that sort of thing, and how that can inform the way we think about politics moving forward. Okay, so that's it for this week on the Affairs Current. Do you have anything final to add before we wrap up, Adam?
Just one quick thought on Isaiah Berlin there. I just want to point out that his classic lecture, article, whatever you call it, Two Concepts of Liberty, is a classic of 20th century philosophy. People should read it. His distinction between positive and negative liberty is fantastic, and I think it really is illuminating for kind of contemporary debates on political and human rights.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And do you have anything final to add just about the show or anything, or where people can reach you if they want to get more in contact?
Yeah, sure thing. So, first off, it's great being back on a podcast format. I didn't realize how much I missed it until now. In terms of, I love this too. I love being able to talk about these kind of like really pressing issues. I'm easily contacted through Facebook, LinkedIn, anything like that, or even if people see me around at the Monk School.
Okay, so yeah, we'll definitely link to your LinkedIn profile off the blog there. Okay, so just to wrap up, once again, our email, theaffairscurrent@gmail.com, affairscurrent.blogspot.com for all the show notes and links and everything like that. I'm Carter Vance, and for Adam and for everybody else here at the Affairs Current, I wish you goodbye and I wish you a pleasant week.